Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Chapin Hemingway, joined as always by Lee Carlo and Jeremy Fisk. And before we start, we just want to remind you that all our episodes are now available on iTunes. And it'd be really helpful if you guys would rate us and subscribe. And is there anything else? Maybe we're even write a review. That'd be cool. That used to matter or something back in the day. But
I mean, it would help our ego, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Even a bad review would be like, oh, wow.
Tyson,
yeah, someone listened to it.
But today, most importantly, we will be discussing the new film Annihilation, directed by Alex Garland. And then we're going to move on to a discussion of the state of sci-fi movies. And then we're going to wrap it all up with our top five movies about fear and dread.
Can you describe its form?
No.
Start from the beginning.
What do you think I do when you're away? You think I'm out in the garden pining, looking up at the sky? Why aren't you here?
I gotta leave a day early.
Your husband's here.
Let me see him.
He's extremely ill.
You have to tell me where he was, what he was doing.
It was his decision to go in. It's something they termed the Shimmer.
We've sent in drones and teams of people, but nothing comes back. But something has.
You're a biologist. You served in the military.
If I knew what happened, I could save his life.
The boundary's getting bigger, it's expanding. We're talking cities, states.
You need to know what's inside. So do I.
We all saw Annihilation, and I think we're going to talk more about sci-fi movies later, but I do wonder, because I know I'm a bigger fan of this genre than you guys are, but I do wonder, can filmmakers really say something with these kind of movies? Is that a good
question? Mean something like about the current state or about our world with sci-fi?
Yeah, I mean like this movie was set in I guess the near future or something, but it is very sort of removed from reality in a way, and I wonder if that removal, if that sort of step back from reality, can put real analysis and saying something about whatever modern times at a distance, making it kind of impossible.
I mean, to answer your question, which really has nothing to do with the movie, is yes, I think that's why people dabble in sci-fi. That's why it's an interesting genre, because you can get away with things you can't get away with, but amplify certain aspects of life with science fiction. I mean, that's what's cool about it. And I mean, as a person who's written in the past, I always, and not even a big sci-fi fan in general. I mean, I like them, but I'm not drawn to it as a genre, like just because of the genre. I'll be drawn to it because of, you know, the movie itself. But as a person who's written stuff in the past, I found myself writing a lot of sci-fi because you're able to tap into something that you can't tap into with a more traditional or current movie. And that's what's cool about the genre, and that's what good sci-fi movies try to do.
Yeah, I do think that we maybe want to save a little bit of this for our conversation later, because I actually wrote down kind of a similar Similar question to that for our discussion later, but Jeremy, you brought up kind of a good point, which applies to this movie about kind of the opportunity to do anything. And I think that's dangerous. And I think it kind of shows with Annihilation.
It's dangerous, you know, if you can't, if you do it wrong.
Well, not only that, whether you do it wrong, but it just gives you this kind of unlimited freedom, and it can kind of explain away anything, which I think, and I guess that would be doing it wrong from a writing standpoint, but I think that Annihilation kind of falls victim to that, you know, especially when we get to the end. And I think we should just preface that all our podcasts are the spoiler edition podcasts.
Especially this one.
Yeah, it's just too hard. And I mean, honestly, Annihilation has been out for long enough. And, you know, for those of you in the UK, you got it on Netflix. So I think, you know, with the end here, you know, it's very hard to make the argument that the means justified the end, that like it was earned, because it just kind of, it could have been anything. Like, it could have been aliens. It could have been, you know, science. It could have been anything. And I think that it's just almost a cheap way of wrapping these movies up, but you say it's sci-fi, so it's acceptable.
Yeah.
And I don't want to jump right into the end, but that's sort of my thought on what Jeremy was saying.
No, yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of the reason I asked you guys this question is because, I mean, I love, in many ways, I love that about movies, right? Like, the, you know, leaving the movie and not knowing entirely what it was about, right? Like, you know, we've said this often on this podcast. We don't want things, you know, you don't want things spelled out for you, right? You want to think about movies. You want to think about them. You want to be asked questions. You want to, you know, you want to be figuring them out. Like, a great movie, maybe not a great movie, but one part of one sort of nice thing about a movie experience is to, you know, have it kind of stay with you after you've watched it, think about it. And I think this one did, but I guess my question kind of came from this leaving the theater, not knowing exactly, you know, how I felt about the movie and not knowing entirely what the movie was about. And not knowing exactly, you know, I didn't necessarily understand the ending. I mean, I had my own problems with the ending, but I didn't ultimately understand, how the kind of the story wrapped up. And because of that, I was like, well, you know, Ex Machina and other movies that Alex Garland has written, I think, do have a lot to say. They do. And he's someone that I, you know, I want to understand. I want to understand his films, but I had a lot of trouble, you know, kind of like maybe in a different way, Lieb, for you with Tree of Life. But I left the movie not quite understanding what the movie was about, and thus not really understanding what this guy is really trying to say with his sort of very unique and in many ways, you know, interesting and kind of wonderful movie. But yeah, that's kind of where that question came from.
Well, Chapin, to be honest, I think you're giving this movie way, way too much credit. I honestly thought it was bad. I really had hard time. It wasn't the ending that didn't do it for me, although I agree I had no idea what it was trying to say at the end or exactly where it was trying to go with it. But I literally have a note here, was what was this movie saying? The message was muddled. I felt like this was a maybe second draft of what should have been a 10 draft script. I just felt the character development was terrible. I mean, I can name a lot of things. Like, the character development was terrible in this movie. Everything was exposition. We're supposed to feel for these people, because there was like a half minute canoe ride where one girl says, oh yeah, that one tries to kill herself, and that one over there, I don't remember, there was some other issue, and that one has cancer. Oh, okay, so there we go. Now the rest of it, you're supposed to feel for them. The way their relationships were together, the fact that they really, I felt like, had no chemistry between them. I had so many problems, mostly with the writing of this movie, but I mean, there were points I was laughing out loud every time they said, what is that? And it's like, you don't fucking know what it is. Obviously, you're in a whole new world. Or they asked, are you okay? Like, this is, it was just lazy writing, bad character development. Nothing about the, I don't understand why they added the, or what they were trying to get at with the science. And it was so muddled. This whole movie was just so muddled to me. And it never worked. There was like a half moment in it where I thought it was starting to turn, where she first saw the flowers and the genetics, and she started to explain them. Like, oh, okay, this movie knows what it's doing. I got to give it a break here. And then no, it fell back off the cliff, and honestly, it turned into The Happening to me.
No, well, that's an endorsement if I've ever heard one.
Jeez,
I guess I kind of agree to a certain extent with both of you. Like, Chapin, I'm with you where, like, I had a really hard time kind of dissecting how I felt about this movie. And I think I got a little bit wrapped up in the end and thinking about, like, how I felt about that and whether or not it was earned. But the further away I've gotten from this, which now a few weeks, I'm a little bit more with you, Jeremy. And if I had to give it a thumbs up or thumbs down, I'd give it a thumbs down. But I'm not as hard on it as you are. I don't think the acting was particularly good, which is sort of what I blamed for the.
No, that's the writing. I mean, I think Natalie Portman was fine, but I think she wasn't.
I don't think she was great. Yeah, I mean,
I don't think she was great. Better. I think Jennifer Jason Leigh was fine, but like the supporting characters were not very good. But I don't necessarily blame them. I just think the writing was bad. I mean, you really can't say. 7 times in a movie where you're exploring basically a new world. What is that? And, you know, expect that to be good, like, expect that to go over. It's.
Well, the reason I think I gave it a little, or I forgave it, I guess, would be maybe a more appropriate, is that literally my first reaction to this was that it was like a female-driven Predator. But honestly, I give it more credit than that because, and it's not even, it doesn't even have anything to do with the movie. It's the fact that it's not the female Ghostbusters or it's not Ocean's 8 with Sandra Bullock. It's not this gimmick that like they have to make the female version of a movie.
I almost want to just review this sort of movie refreshing. Separately from whether they were male or female.
Well, no,
because
and you
I
can.
Feel like once we add that to it, then it becomes a different thing. I just think
no, but that's my point. Is that it is separate from that, and that's what was refreshing about it for me. Is that okay. it wasn't the female version of Predator. It was right. just it could have been males or female. It didn't matter, and that for me was refreshing to just have these characters in the movie. So I guess that allowed me to forgive some of its flaws. I don't even know if that's actually true because.
Why did that let you forgive the flaws? Because
I don't even. Yeah, I'm not sure because I just remember feeling refreshed by that, and then you know, and then I take the aspect that like I sort of agree with Chapin with, and that I was a little bit wrapped up with trying to figure out how I felt about the movie because I maybe didn't totally understand what he was trying to say, and you put those two things together, and I guess it becomes sort of a thought-provoking film as opposed to something that really does perhaps have a lot of flaws. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I get where you're coming from, but I honestly think it starts and ends with the writing. I mean, like, for example, there was this point where when they first get into the, what was it called there?
The Shimmer?
The Shimmer,
yeah. Yeah, sorry. When they lost their memory. And then I was like,
yeah, which
oh,
they never came back
yeah.
to. That was ridiculous.
And then
yeah.
I thought that was interesting. And then literally they never lost their memory again. That was not a thing that was a part of it. All of a sudden, why didn't they wear hazmat suits going into it? First of all, if everybody else who's gone into it has died, why would you not wear a hazmat suit going into it? That made no sense.
I did think it was interesting that they were all dressed like the Ghostbusters.
They were dressed like the Ghostbusters, I think very much on purpose. And then the fact that Natalie Portman's just like, hey, can I be part of this mission? And they're like, yeah, sure, you join us. And like, why did that one lady need to be a lesbian and an EMT? Served no purpose. there was just a lot of bad writing in this that like didn't go anywhere, that started out somewhere and you thought, okay, well, I'll see some sort of payoff for this later, right? Obviously, he's not going to just, you know, make her an EMT for no reason other than to say later when she witnesses something everybody else witnesses to say it's a trick of the light. Like, I don't know. I didn't like it.
Yeah.
And that'll wrap things up here.
The Get Your Film Fix podcast. I don't know. Am I wrong?
Like,
I agree with everything that you've said.
I think you're picking on the wrong thing, actually. I'm not denying that those are, I mean, you're pointing these things out to me and I'm not denying them. I don't think that they are, you're incorrect. They just didn't bother me a whole bunch when I was watching them. I mean, to me, what was really sort of frustrating were these unresolved sort of plot points, right? The bigger ones.
Those were there too.
What is this place? And you've got all these things happening to these people. Like one, you know, they're like, there's this big mystery. Like what happened to the first crew, right? Which is a similar convention used in Sunshine, which is also written by Alex Garland. And it's like this. It's interesting, right? Like these guys went into this place and they just disappeared. Or we know that one came out, and so we're sort of expecting or wondering or what's going to happen to them that's going to split them up. And they say it twice. Again, goes back to sort of bad writing, Jeremy, where they say, well, they either turned on each other or something in the Shimmer got them. Okay, so we're waiting for one of those two things to happen, and in many ways the characters are too, right? So they're waiting for this to happen. One of them. You know, two of them are attacked by the same animal, which seems to kill them. And then another one, which
is silly because, like, also, why is there only one animal in this place that's supposed to be so nutrient and, like, diversity dense?
Right.
And they run into one animal.
Yeah, it does it twice.
And it does it twice.
And then this, you know, the Tessa Thompson character sort of like. Like what happened to her? She sort of just like wandered off and became a plant or something. Like,
yeah, That's what I'm talking about. The happening.
Yeah.
And same with, what's her name? Jennifer Jason Leigh's character.
Right. We don't really know.
I forget where she went. Where did she go?
She went into the lighthouse and then, you know, turned into a light.
Well, like, so I'm kind of with Chapin as far as my overall like stance on the movie, but I literally wrote down here, it's a bit sloppy in parts, which sort of leads to what you're talking about, Jeremy. But then my bigger point is that the bigger problem with this movie is that it sort of unfolds into something about a space where anything is possible. So the conclusion can just be anything, and it doesn't give you any concrete solutions to the bigger plot points, which was Chapin's point.
You're right. Like, good sci-fi movies have parameters and rules, and this one really didn't seem to have any. And like, even the basic questions, which I don't tend to ask, like, you guys know me, I don't ask these questions, but this one was just screaming for those questions to be asked, and it didn't establish any sort of rules. And then on top of it, to make it 10 times worse, it didn't establish any character development between these girls. And then to make it 20 times worse, the big plot points were a mess. So, like, really, what do you have here? What are you ultimately latching on?
I think it's particularly frustrating because I think if we film geeks, film people who are a little more sophisticated about movies than the average person would tell filmmakers to make movies like this, right? Like, leave them guessing. Like, let them come to their own conclusions. Let people.
I love that in the end of a movie, but not like, I mean, you just, I guess, never.
My point being that, like, the sort of the Hollywood way of doing it, and it's interesting, this movie specifically, we can get into that a little bit later, but like the Hollywood way of doing things is to over explain, is to show and not, is to tell and not show, you know, like to make people, you know, assume the audience is not going to get it. Right. And it's interesting because one of the guys who funded this movie, David Ellison, you know, was upset by poor test screenings. They screened it for, you know, a, a group of people, and my guess is they had a similar reaction to us, or they didn't understand it, right? The average John Q. public person went to see it and didn't like it, and they wanted to change the ending, and I assume kind of iron some things out, like we're talking about right now. But Scott Rudin produced this, and he's a pretty powerful producer, and I think Alex Garland had final cut, and so the international rights for the movie were sold to Netflix, right? So Lee made mentioned this earlier, that, you know, everywhere else but in the United States is available on Netflix because Netflix bought the international distribution rights. And so I don't know, like what's hard for me here is because I want people to make movies, you know, in a very general way like this, like Alex Garland did with Annihilation, but it didn't work here. It didn't work for me.
Yeah, but right? you need people to fall. Like, I understand what you're saying, Chapin, but this movie was messy from the get-go, and it didn't have the character development needed. Like, if you can follow the characters and you can follow the relationships, then you got something. What, depending on how you leave the audience, they're least hanging on to those things, which are really important in a movie. In this movie, it didn't have those. There was no sympathy, not no sympathy, but no connection to those characters. And I think also audiences, especially in the sci-fi genre, which we'll talk about in a little bit, are more sophisticated because of the recent ones coming out. So I think this sort of failed on all those fronts.
Okay, but like let me just put this forward. And I know you guys aren't a huge fan of this movie, but let's say like 2001, right? I think a lot of people would watch the movie even today, even as revered as it is today, and say, "What the fuck was that about?" And they'd watch the Starman sequence, they'd watch the wormhole sequence, and they'd be like, "This is outrageous." But I mean, that movie needs to exist. I mean, it's a brilliant movie, in my opinion, and I don't know. I'm conflicted because I feel like. I don't know. I'm not sure what I'm.
I'm totally with you, Chapin. Because I give this movie a little credit for exploring that idea this is not for, you know, this is not a popcorn movie. You know, it's a movie that you have to really kind of digest and think about and be thought provoking. And I think to a certain extent that he succeeded in that. And I think there are some things that he did well. On the flip side, I can't disagree with a single thing that you said, Jeremy, that about the flaws in this movie. Like every single one of them, I totally agree with. But I keep saying that I guess I was a little bit more forgiving of it. I don't even know if that's actually the right word, as much as that I found the movie thought provoking, which I think was ultimately the intention. So in that aspect, it was a success. So it's hard to, you know. It's hard to say that and then also say it wasn't a very good movie.
Well, I feel like it's thought-provoking in that you either just – because you have to try – your brain has to rationalize something of why you sat there for so long and watched it. I think you have to be like, okay, well, what was that? And
well,
it's thought provoking.
I don't know if that's totally it, because he does. I mean, you even pointed out that there's a good amount of exposition in the movie, and I read a thing that says that it's supposed to be like the whole theme of the movie is supposed to be like a metaphor for cancer, and it has to do with like her whole studying, you know, the how cells reproduce and become duplicates of themselves, and that the shimmer itself is cancer and how all these things continue to grow. And, you know, my frustration with that is that like anytime you have to, if you have to read something to explain the movie to you, then it's not doing its job well enough.
Yeah. You know? I thought that too. I was like, maybe some of this stuff's cancer, but what does that have to do with the main character? The main character's side plot had nothing to do with anything. It was her having some random affair with some random character
that had nothing to do
with anything. Like, again, it was sloppy writing.
Yeah, I agree. I'm trying to uncover why I didn't feel is negative on this movie after leaving it, as you did, when, you know, I do sort of agree with a lot of the things you pointed out. And I, again, it's not some, it's in the weeks that have passed, it's not a movie that I've felt particularly fond of. But it wasn't necessarily for those reasons. It was more from the fact that, like, I don't feel like its ending was earned, that its themes and its point were well enough established. I had a bigger problem with, I had a problem with the bigger picture, more so than the small pieces. But at the same time, like, I guess I wasn't as down on it as you were.
Yeah, it's interesting that, I mean, honestly, it's kind of interesting that you guys came out of it trying to grasp something. And maybe that's, you know, that's credit to the movie. I mean, you know, but I came out of it frustrated.
Yeah, I mean, I did too. I can't deny that I wasn't frustrated. And I'm not... I think what maybe Lee and I are trying to, I want to be more forgiving of this movie because I admire it for trying. I admire that it took a different path. I mean, maybe it wasn't the most successful path, right? Like, I actually think that Alex Garland, like, he talked about that this is, I guess, one in a series of like two or three novels. Guy wrote a couple, 10 or 15
but apparently
years
it's
ago.
Nothing like it.
Yeah. And it's nothing like it. He's like, it's more, he said, you know, I consider it more like a dream version of the movie or of the book. Like it's just an interpretation. And I mean, I think you can kind of see that, right? Like this is at least what I have the problem with, this idea of like, we haven't established what this thing is and the rules of it. And, you know, what's really interesting about this movie, what the movie asks you to be interested in, it doesn't tell you enough about, right? Like, okay, fair enough. The characters, they're not very developed. You know, that happens in sci-fi movies. Maybe they don't get along. Jeremy, you identified some sort of unbelievable moments, some moments where you don't understand why people are there. And fine, I'm willing to forgive that if you can, you know, really kind of hook me with the and I think I was, like, for most of the time, you know, I was on the edge of my seat. I was, you know, the tension is there, right? It's and it's wound very tightly. But you just, like, come out of it, like, not really understanding it, but the film is, like, telling you, you should, right? And that is just frustrating.
I think maybe the reason I was maybe perhaps higher on the movie after leaving and spent so much time thinking about these bigger picture things is because partly because what I was saying before and how it was, I found it refreshing that it was not this gimmicky female cast. But then in another area, like, I thought, you know, it wasn't like a gimmicky use of CGI or anything. Like, again, he creates this world where literally anything is possible. And before this movie, there was a trailer for Pacific Rim. And then I don't know what's that new movie with The Rock that's, like, got ridiculous CGI'd animals in it.
Oh, Rampage.
Rampage. So I saw those two trailers, which is just ridiculous. But then in this movie, I feel like he uses CGI well, like that. You know, say what you want about whether or not it was the only animal in the area, but that bear was pretty well done and integrated into the story relatively well. So I feel like there were bits that were refreshing for me as far as, you know, what this movie was in the world of movies that we're getting these days. I take those things, and then I see the problems with the bigger picture. So those refreshing aspects allowed me to forgive those smaller bits and pieces that you're talking about, Jeremy.
Yeah, and I think those things, to me, just made them that much more frustrating. I mean,
I can see that.
Like, that crocodile was so cool, but, like, I know it's so silly, and I don't usually pick on stuff like this, but it really, like, little stuff like this, like, it grabbed her, pulled her underwater, this, like, size of a shark, didn't eat her.
And she was fine.
Like, I don't know. It was.
No, that was such a bad horror movie. So this will bring us a little bit into the Alex Garland discussion, and I'll kind of direct it to you, Chapin, because I think that
Before you do that, can I just ask you guys something? Because I don't. Yeah. You can cut this out of the podcast if it's stupid, but I'm curious. That house they went into that was in The Shimmer, was that supposed to be Natalie Portman's house?
Yeah.
Because it,
I read that later. I didn't notice it.
I have no idea.
Yeah, I noticed it during, and I was like, "What does this mean?" And I thought they would explain it. And I thought, "Okay, here we go. Now something's happening." And then nothing.
I don't even know what you're talking about. The house where they find, like, the video and stuff. that has, what house did they go into?
No, they went into a house and they were going to, like, I think it was the house where the bear attacked the,
Right.
That's apparently Natalie Portman's house because it's the same house.
How did you notice that?
Obviously, because of the stairs. They do that same shot at the stairs a couple times in her house.
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, I mean, there's weird things like they have that tattoo of the serpent eating itself and it kind of like jumps mm-hmm. from character to character.
But that's just another example of what Chapin was talking about, and sort of you too, Jeremy, about it needing more drafts or something. But it's just like it's such a good effort, but they didn't put a good enough effort in. Like the idea is a good effort, like to do this, but it's not.
But
fully
again,
realized.
In the end, what idea? Like, what are we?
Yeah,
even
I mean,
talking
what does
about?
That mean? What like?
No, I know
like,
that's the
what
problem,
is any
right?
of it? Like, right. what idea is this? And I think that's the ultimate flaw of this movie. And I think it sums up our argument perfectly. Not much of an argument, but whatever argument we have.
No,
you're saying
like,
it was a good idea, and then I'm saying what idea?
No, it's like he had a good idea for a couple little... No, I agree. It's like he had an idea... Like, he had these little bits of ideas, like, about how this sort of works, but never found the pieces that pull it all together.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you're... It's like when you... It's. I'm trying to think of an example, but it's like if you... You have this little tiny, like, small idea, and you decide to, like, that's going to be it. You're going to make a whole movie out of that, but you never are able to expand on it. So you just have this small little plot point. Like, you know, her house somehow exists inside this other world. So he got that idea, and then he's like, okay, how can I elaborate that and make a full movie out of it? And then he found some other pieces, but was never able to fully realize it.
But that's like, do you spend whatever million of dollars on it and make it into a movie?
Hopefully that's not where it started, right? Like, wouldn't it be fucked up if we built this weird world, this thing crashing, and then the whole idea is centered around the fact that she goes into the shimmer and she's in her own house.
But what does it mean, Alex? Alex, what does it mean?
But we're not going to point it out. You know, it's not going to be obvious enough that everybody realizes it. You have to read it on a website later to figure it out. I mean, like, what does that say? Like, that totally changes at least my understanding of what this thing is.
Yeah, I don't
know. I don't know, and we still don't know what it means. Like, that's the thing. It's cancer.
I mean, I think Alex Garland clearly has, like, a really creative mind, right? But I think going into this movie, I was really high on him. And it has a lot to do with Ex Machina and sort of just like the pedigree of Sunshine and 28 Days Later, even though they're not movies I particularly love. He also wrote the screenplay for Never Let Me Go, which is a movie we talked about on the podcast years ago. Now, oddly, I'm actually like feeling like I'm actually really low on him because the more I think about it, I'm seeing a lot of the same problems. Never Let Me Go, our big gripe with that, and I actually watched it again relatively recently, and I still had the same problem, is that it's a movie... And Jeremy, you mentioned it with Annihilation. It needs another draft of the script. Like it's not hitting the important points hard enough, and it's leaving out important points or smaller points that need to be there to make everything work and turn it into a really great movie. And Never Let Me Go had that problem. We even based our top five off of that. And Annihilation had that problem. And I remember Sunshine. I liked up until the end. I didn't buy the ending, because I didn't feel like it was earned. It was another situation where he sort of created a situation where anything could happen. It could have been anything, right? Where this person was just always there. So now I'm starting to see these problems that continue to exist, and I'm starting to just not really like what he does.
Well, I don't think that's right. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to argue with what you just said, but I don't know. I think we have to sort of nurture filmmakers like this, and we have to look out for them and appreciate them even when they don't do things that we like. I mean, I don't know that, you know, that in ingenuity and you know, innovative stories and things that we don't really see often come at the expense of storyline and You know, I don't know. What was your problem with Never Let Me Go? The believability? I mean,
it's such an interesting story, and it's a really unique love story.
And it's also based on a book too. I started to read
the right. book. Yeah, I haven't gotten a chance to read it yet.
I missed reading the book
too. Yeah. So, all right. Well, it's such a unique love story, and it does actually a really good job of kind of creating or just kind of throwing you into this world. And it doesn't, it definitely has some exposition and explaining everything, which is necessary, but it was really hard. Even when we talked about it on the podcast, it was really hard for any of us to put our finger on what was missing, but there was something missing. And our top five that week was movies that just missed for us. And that to me comes down to a script needing another draft. Or, you know, really needing to go through it maybe one or two more times. So that was my problem with Never Let Me Go. And Jeremy mentioned with Annihilation that it was the second draft of a script that needed 10 drafts, which is, I think, kind of an appropriate criticism. So I just seeing this trend that I think is discouraging for him. And I agree with you that we need filmmakers like this.
I agree. Like, weirdly, I agree with both of you here. Like, I agree with Chapin. We do need filmmakers like this. We need filmmakers that are going to try these new things and go into new areas. But I think also, Lee, you're right. Like, when these errors start getting repeated over and over and over again, like, they need to get beyond them. They need to grow. They need to correct these problems. And then at this point, at Annihilation, it's been enough time where we can be like, all right, well, now it's not good. Like, now we're just looking at a product that's, I'm sorry, but it's just, it doesn't work. And I think that's fair too. I agree with both of you on that.
I guess.
And I think it's discouraging because I really liked Ex Machina, but now I kind of want to go back and watch it again and kind of, you know, look for maybe these flaws, which isn't fair, right, to do that. But
no, yeah. Know, and Ex Machina really was a good movie.
I liked it a lot, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess, okay, like, I think my argument is that you take a movie like Sunshine, and it's not, you know, not a lot of people have seen it, but it's an original idea, and it's interesting to me because of sort of the premise of it, you know, the shimmer of it, for lack of a better word, right? Like the overall, the story, right? That's why I'm into sci-fi movies, and like people going places they've never been before and the consequences of that, and you know, how that affects them, these sort of what's the word I'm looking for? It's kind of, you know, these things that are beyond, you know, they talk about, you know, you're able to talk about these sort of profound things of human existence, these sort of existential ideas, you know, and yeah, like it's a little silly that, you know, at the end of the road of this movie, that it's kind of turns into a slasher movie. I mean, at the end of Sunshine, spoiler alert, there's a guy sort of, you know, seemingly, that incomprehensibly attacks our lead characters as they're trying to, you know, solve the movie basically. And yeah, it's a little cheap and it seems like a stupid thing, but I guess my point about this is that I'm willing to overlook that. And it's not that it's not a problem for me. Of course it's a problem, but I love every other aspect of that movie. I love so much that these original ideas that I don't really care that much that there are these kind of, these like little, you know, movie problems here and there. I'm willing to forgive them because I the ideas interest me so much. And I'm not saying that's what happened with Annihilation, because obviously I didn't understand it enough to love it. But
I agree with what you just said about Sunshine, but I don't think that translates to Annihilation. I think Annihilation gets it wrong from step one.
No, I agree. I don't think it does either.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing about the genre, is that you can have that reaction to it, where there are flaws, but you can look past them because of the subject matter or the situation that the characters are put in. But like that just lends even more credit to the movies that do it really well, that they're able to, you know, create these worlds or these situations or these stories, but hit on all these small little pieces, and everything does work and tie well together. And you know, I think what's a challenge for sci-fi movies, and in that genre is that they have this added pressure that because so often, you know, there are movies that you need to, that are thought provoking, you need to really think about and understand, but that, you know, they need to be good enough for you to want to go and see them again. Like, I don't want to see Annihilation again, but it, seeing it again maybe might help understand what it's all about. So they have this added pressure.
Wreckage.
Where's the rest?
Where's the mountains?
Those aren't mountains. They're waves.
Oh shit. Oh shit.
That one's moving away from us.
We need the recorder.
Doyle, back to the Ranger now.
We're not leaving without her data.
Get back here now. We do not have time. The second wave is coming. We're in the middle of a swell.
I got it.
Get your ass back to the Ranger now. Brand, get back here now.
So yeah, so that transitions us into talking about the recent sci-fi genre, maybe the last 5-6 years, where I've been noticing a trend of sci-fi movies where there's these sci-fi movies are based in more of science and reality, starting like sort of having their roots there and then going from that. And I feel like movies like The Martian, Interstellar, Arrival, all are movies that are like fall into that genre. And I also think like Annihilation like tried to sort of put its roots in there, but just never was able to do it. I don't know. What do you guys think? Have you felt something different with the sci-fi genre since, you know, I don't even know where it started, whether it was Interstellar, The Martian, but it seems like those are, yeah, I guess it would be Interstellar because that was a year before The Martian. That's sort of where sci-fi is going from when we were kids, where it seems so far-fetched and so out there and so crazy with just aliens and you know, these things that you could never imagine. And now it's like, oh, okay, let's start it where we can kind of put a reality basis to it and go from
there.
Yeah,
they're like more sophisticated in a way, right? Like, and I think they're more grounded.
Right.
You know, I don't know that I think of Interstellar has sci-fi ideas. I mean, it's about space travel, but I don't know that I would consider that a sci-fi movie.
Oh, definitely. It's a sci-fi movie. I mean, they go to different... I mean, it's definitely... I mean
the
go
sci-fi genre is like the widest genre because like it can be science, it can be fiction, it can be space, it can be Earth. Like,
yeah,
it's
that's true. But I was like leaning more towards the ones I was just talking about. Those ones that seem to be like space travel or like Annihilation, like stuff that tries to root itself in like science and then sort of spread off of that in a way that we can kind of relate to.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting observation. I think it's generally good. I think it's, but you know,
but like even Arrival, which is, it involves aliens. I feel like it really kind of, you know, it was about Amy Adams as, I don't know what her actual job
was. Yeah, she was like a linguist.
Linguist, yeah. Or, yeah, a translator. Yeah, you know, it's like that's where it started, and that's sort of based in that. It wasn't...
Well, I think that's an interesting example, because that takes... Arrival sort of takes that sci-fi genre of old and brings in maybe a more realistic and grounded element to it. So, like, mm-hmm. You have the aliens coming, you even sort of the end of that movie sort of is a little, not totally set in reality, it's very sci-fi in its conclusion where, you know, everything has already happened and all that crap. But, like, I think where it fits your point is Amy Adams' character is instead of having, you know, the Will Smith Independence Day character that needs to go fight the aliens, you have
right.
a teacher or a linguist try to mm-hmm. communicate with them in a sort of
out their language,
educated yeah. way. Yeah, I think that makes sense. I sort of was kind of going in a different direction with this topic when I suggested it, although I like kind of what you have to say a little bit more, you know, and I was thinking that you have this clear divide between the, you know, what people expect from sci-fi genre, which is the big budgets and the CGI Star Wars movies, and then smaller movies like Annihilation. And I was thinking of like Jeff Nichols with Midnight Special, and even some of it, even, you know, Take Shelter is not really sci-fi, but it, you know, in the sense that it, you know, is science fiction, but some of his movies have sort of that element. And I think they, a lot of times they are speaking to, you know, where we are in the world. They're trying to make a comment on that. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot from sci-fi films, is they're trying to be a little bit more based in the present than in the future. Even if they're creating this sort of alternate future, it's an alternate near future, I think.
Right. And you see that with like episodes of Black Mirror, which really just fits right in, I don't know if you guys watch that, but that fits right into that, yeah, right into that category. But I mean, you also got movies like Primer and Upstream Color. I haven't seen Upstream Color, but like Primer is another one that's just kind of based in the science, and then it spreads from that, and you know, your plot goes on from that. So I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm just seeing something that's not there, but I feel
no, I
like
think you definitely are
ignoring like the big budget sort of Pacific Rims and the, you know, rock movies with, like, I'm talking about these sort of I don't know if introspective is the right word, but these technical grounded sci-fi movies. And they're becoming really popular too, and they're doing really well. And I, you know, I like to see it. And it's movies like Arrival that make me realize that Annihilation was just not a, you know, didn't work. So
yeah, I mean, I think you guys are identifying two different things here. I think what sort of makes Arrival and Interstellar sort of work, what those two things play on, is that those two ideas, those two plot points have been explored in sort of less sophisticated, bigger budget movies. And so it's almost as if those, you know, Nolan and whoever the other director is of that movie. Denis Villeneuve, you know, they're playing on the sort of our perception of those conventions. And the fact that we have, you know, it's almost like, you know, the thinking man's Independence Day, or like, you know, we've seen this all before, but it's like, it's different twist on it. It's like a realistic look at how that would really develop, which is always the most sort of interesting thing for me. And like, it's kind of what you're saying, Lee, I go for movies like Midnight Special, like movies that look at these sort of fantastical ideas. And it goes on another level for me. Like, I'm interested in how an $18-20 million movie is going to explore something that is hard to represent, you know, on a low budget, right? Like, idea, you know, it not only does it have the sort of the bandwidth, it doesn't have that, you know, it doesn't have to appeal to a wider audience. And so they're allowed to explore these more introspective ideas. But also they have to kind of, in a lot of ways, like we saw in Annihilation, and I think in Midnight Special and in some other cases, explore these really kind of fantastic set pieces in a creative way. You know, they have to show these things, but they have to do them in a way that they can afford. And I think a lot of times that leads to really interesting filmmaking.
So one last question I want to ask you guys about the sci-fi genre, because I think it kind of ties into Annihilation a little bit. Do you think that movies within that genre should be seen only once? And I guess what I'm asking, like, is it more important to have a movie that's asking questions and exploring themes that are difficult to like understand within that genre? Or do you think it's okay, you can still have a good movie in that genre and a thought-provoking movie if it's something you only need to see once? Does that make sense? Because with like Annihilation, it falls into a category, like I was saying before, where you might, it's probably not good enough to want to see it twice, but you might need to totally understand it. And that's sort of what me and Chapin appreciated about it, is that it was something that you really had to think about. Can there be a good sci-fi movie that you only have to see once?
Yeah, I think it should. Like, I think it should leave that impression on you where you maybe want to see it again, but you don't need to see it again. I think it's really almost selfish of the filmmakers this day and age, when people have so many things to watch and so much content, to try to make a film where you go, well, you have to see it twice to really get it. I disagree
with you a little bit. I mean, I agree that that's selfish, that you shouldn't, you know, if some director's like, well, look, you're at a film festival, and they say, well, you know, look, you really need to see this again.
No, stay in your seat. We're playing it again.
One more time, and then you'll really understand the subtleties. That's annoying. But I mean, I want to be that sort of traditionalist that says, yeah, one time in the movie theater, just like in the old days, like in the 40s, it should be all you need. But I mean, that's just not accurate. I mean, I need to see things a couple times to really appreciate them.
But those things you need to see a couple times to appreciate them, you kind of want to, right? Like, you're not...
Well, that's what I was talking about with this added pressure, where, like, they need to create a movie. Like, those movies that do that, they also have the pressure of making a movie that's good enough for that you have to, that you want to see it again.
All you care about is money. This town deserves a better class of criminal. And I'm going to give it to them. Tell your men they work for me now. This is my city.
They won't work for the freak.
Why don't we cut you up into little pieces and feed you to your pooches? Hmm? And then we'll see how loyal a hungry dog really is. It's not about money. It's about sending a message. Everything burns.
Okay, so for our top five, we're doing our top five movies about fear or dread or whatever. And this really came for me from, I was intrigued by Annihilation, I guess more the trailer and the idea of it, because I love that sense of a movie, just, I guess, the main emotion being dread, and that, like, you go in and from the start, you know, something's wrong. And the movie is about, like, figuring out what's wrong and like, this pathway that you know is going to lead somewhere terrible, right? And I think it's an interesting subgenre, and I feel like I have a feeling in my mind about what this movie is, and I don't know that if I've discovered it in my top five or not, but I will say this will be my Sunshine Memorial list.
Yep.
So,
fair enough. It's an honorable mention for me.
My number five is going to be Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo.
Interesting.
Lee, didn't you recently say?
I just rewatched it, and I really, really did not like that movie.
Really? I haven't seen it.
Yeah, which is
a long
funny, because if, like, I mean, it's that movie. It's one of those movies that just, like, when you're growing up through film school and, you know, all, it's a movie that you have to see, and you not only have to see, but you have to like. And I don't remember if it ended up on our Get Your Film Fix Top 100 or not.
I loved it. I loved that movie.
I just,
but
really,
again, that's a revisit.
Really didn't like it. I was, and I, both Lydia and I kind of felt the same way. And you know, while she's not nearly as
sophisticated, smart, educated, good looking.
Well, I was going to say she's not nearly as involved in watching movies as we are these days, but she went to film school too. She went to Emerson with you guys. So Vertigo was one of those movies that she was sort of forced to watch and forced to like, and I think it's a perfect example of something that we were forced to like, and I just thought it was not good. But you're number five.
Can you go specifically talk a little bit more about why you didn't like it? Because I haven't seen it for ages. I just remember that being the feeling I had when I watched it.
It doesn't work. Like, it just, the twist is, and my first thought was maybe because I knew the twist going in, so maybe it was something that you had, it would only work when you didn't know what it was. But it was never believable in like what what Jimmy Stewart was trying to go after and uncover. And it just, it was, I think maybe it has a little bit to do with like that theme has been explored so many times now, that it's stale. Mm-hmm. And you know,
yeah, well, that goes back to Chapin's point.
In 1950s, you know, it was obviously a huge hit. But yeah, it was disappointing. I would be really curious to hear what you guys thought upon revisiting it for sure. Yeah. Because I was so disappointed because like it was just one of those many Hitchcock movies that I really wanted to see again because it had been so long. And like I love Hitchcock. Like Rear Window, I've seen a million times and I still love it. And there's been so many others that I've just kind of revisited over the years. And I just there's very rarely one that I dislike as much as I dislike Vertigo.
Yeah, and I was thinking about putting Rear Window on there, but I you know, that movie is a little too lighthearted for this list. But you know, yeah.
Yeah, with the killing and the, you know.
Yeah, and the voyeurism. But come on, yeah. You know, when Grace Kelly enters the, you know, come on.
Yeah, that's true.
She lights up the whole movie.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Jeremy, why don't you go with your number five?
So I struggled with this because it was hard for me to totally get a concept of what we were doing as far as dread. Like, do you have to feel dread the whole movie? Is it about one character feeling dread, or is it, you know? So, you know, I had a bit of a difficulty, but I think it came together. And I'm calling this my Seventh Seal Memorial List.
That's a great pick, yeah.
Do you know what that do you remember anything about that movie yet?
No, that's the reason I'm calling it my Seventh Seal Memorial List is because I used that for a top five one time and I remembered zero about it, so I'm not going to go ahead and make that same mistake twice.
One of the best clips all time from the podcast, and it came on our first one.
Yeah. So my number five is Dead Man Walking with Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon. A movie I also haven't seen forever, but I did like a lot, and I do remember feeling that sense of dread throughout the movie because you really kind of knew it wasn't going to work out so good.
Did Tim Robbins direct that?
Yeah.
He did, yeah. Yeah, he did. And, I mean, it would be an interesting one to revisit, see how I feel about it today, but I do remember that sense watching it.
You guys remember Tim Robbins?
I know, it's so funny. Well, he's on some HBO thing right now.
Yeah, I just saw he's got a series.
Yeah, everyone's in some sort of series or TV or movie or everyone's fine. Everyone's fine.
All right, so I tried to, I had a hard time with this list too. I actually only came up with five movies, but I'm actually pretty happy with the five I came up with. I was trying to kind of figure out what the difference was between dread and fear. And I sort of settled on kind of the moods of the movie. Like, I felt like a movie about dread also kind of would have this dreadful mood about it. So everything except for my number five sort of have that, but my number five definitely.
Well,
has
did you feel like dread was more like a ominous?
Yes.
Sort of like it's gonna happen.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's not quite.
There's nothing
precise.
Anybody can
not
do about
fear
it.
Where you're just like scared, but like sort of this is unfortunately. Gonna be the outcome.
Yeah, and there's not really anything you can do about it. The characters are, they have no control over the situation. And I think it's sort of painted the most clearly with my number five, even though it doesn't have sort of that darker mood, but it's Dr. Strangelove.
I don't know if I could, I don't know if that...
So for me, it's just that they basically the dread is obviously that the, you know, it's going to start this war, but that whole idea that there's not anything that they can do about it is where it comes from. I think it, and granted, it's
I thought about that movie. I just felt like it was too lighthearted. Yeah,
that was my issue too. And for the rest of my picks, I have I was really trying to focus on the mood of the movie too, because Strangelove obviously is a comedy, and there's so many elements of it that are not. I mean, I suppose I could have gone with Failsafe, but I think Strangelove is a much better movie.
Yeah.
So you know.
No, it's a good pick. It's just I thought about it too. It's a good pick.
All right, my number four is a movie we've discussed several times on this podcast already, and it's Denis Villeneuve's Arrival. You know, it doesn't turn out to be as bad as we think it is, but it is really scary. It's, you know, we're sort of dreading what's happening. I think of it as this like momentum, right? This idea of dread, and you're moving towards something and you don't quite know what it is. And, it seems dangerous. Right. And I think for a lot of the movie, you're doing that. And even when you discover that those, septopods or whatever they're called aren't, you know, violent and don't mean us any harm, it still is a sort of scary and atmospheric because we don't quite understand them. And obviously it's a brilliant movie. I don't know why you don't like it, Lee, but, yeah, that's my number four.
Yeah. And it goes to, again, show you what it did well, that Annihilation couldn't. It gave you a sense of that dread and fear with the actual sort of issue, like with what's the movie you're talking about? Arrival. Sorry. I want to say Annihilation again. With Arrival, it gave you a fear of the aliens. With Annihilation, you never got that sense that, well, maybe you did, but maybe that sort of prism was going to be a terrible thing for mankind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of shows maybe the down. What didn't work about Annihilation is that I think it was they introduced the idea of it spreading and of it growing and enveloping the world, but it wasn't nearly as
you didn't feel that. Yeah.
And you sort of still fear the septopods more in Arrival, even after they've been clearly. They're clearly ambivalent, and I don't know. It's like that idea of creating this atmosphere, and I think that Annihilation was sort of the perfect sort of setting to do that in, and yeah, obviously didn't work.
Right. All right. So my number four. I honestly, we could put any of this guy's movies on this list, and you'd be like, "Yep, makes sense." But I'm gonna go with Lars von Trier's Dancer in the Dark. There's not a moment of levity or lightheartedness in the film. And I remember watching that and being bummed out for quite a while after.
Yeah. You didn't like the end?
Not uplifting.
I haven't seen it. What happens?
She lives, saves the world.
Yeah. It's the prequel to Wonder Woman. All right, my number four is it's a movie that I like, don't love. I wish I liked it more, but because there's definitely no denying the quality of filmmaking in this movie, and this I don't think any denying the sense of dread in this movie. It is Children of Men.
That may show up again. Yeah,
thought it might.
Yeah, kind of a hopeful ending, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. Does it have a hopeful? I mean, I guess a little bit, but
yeah, one kid's not going to be able to do anything.
Okay, is it my turn?
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Another one featuring Miss Natalie Portman, and it's Black Swan. I like that movie. Again, I think I mentioned it on last week's podcast or one of the podcasts previously that I saw this in theaters, Black Swan, and I've seen it once. And kind of the opposite of the discussion we've just had about seeing movies twice. I don't want to see it again because I have a fear that I won't like it as much. But yeah, this was just an emotional movie for me. And I think I was just like, I had that feeling of like, something's wrong.
Well, it's probably because you used to be a ballerina. You didn't tell
it's relatable.
The folks at home about that.
The world's largest male ballerina. but... Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what else to say about that movie, but yeah, it's scary.
All right. Well, I will follow up your Black Swan with one Requiem for a Dream, another Aronofsky movie, and that will be my number three. I don't know what else needs to be said about that movie that hasn't been said. I tried drugs for the first time right after. I thought, whoa, that looks awesome.
You have to do them for a long time to get to where they are. So
I know that's a commitment.
Yeah. The beginning looks great.
Yeah.
All right. My number three, from a director I like quite a bit. There are actually a couple movies I could have included of his, but I'm going with Michael Haneke's Cachet. Basically, family keeps getting these tapes on their doorstep that are basically frightening and, you know, sort of threatening. And there's not anything they can do about it. They don't know where it's coming from. The police can't help, and essentially creates this very dreadful mood and scenario for them. And that's something, obviously, Haneke explores. The White Ribbon was another movie I considered, Jeremy.
Wow, yeah. I love that movie.
Which definitely has it. But Cachet, I liked a little bit more, so I went with that one.
All right, is it my... Thurin, is it number two?
Yeah, you're okay. Number two.
My number two, one of my cult classic favorites, is John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah, I thought about it. It's a movie I kind of would want to see again. I remember we did the podcast on the new one.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Chapin, and we talked about the old one along with it. Yeah, that's such a cool concept. I wish I thought about it. I just don't remember it well enough, but. It's such a cool idea, that the whole storyline in that movie.
Yeah.
All right, so my number two, and this one I was debating, but I think it fits in this, and it's Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Not the entire movie, I had like a feeling of dread, but I don't think it was like always there, but I don't know, I just think it fits. I think it was always trying to point to sort of a I don't know, terrible ending, and you know, I don't know, it's a great movie.
Yeah, I struggled sort of with the dread element of it, but it's definitely a movie that has the mood of dread to it.
Right.
So that's exactly, so that's where I was coming from with that one. The reason I thought about it. All right. My number two, we were joking about reading books earlier. I'm actually listening, to the book, that this movie is mostly based on. Doesn't nearly have the same sort of
Thomas, the Tank Engine.
Doesn't have nearly you know, the dramatic elements and certainly not the mood that the movie has. But it's absolutely fascinating to listen to the stories that Robert Graysmith tells about the Zodiac.
Yeah, no, that's a good one too. Like Taxi Driver, it, you're right. It has that sort of mood.
Well, and just so, and the movie does, like, the movie has such a mood to it, but if you just think about the dread that existed with this, and, you know, with this, you know, unknown killer, just sort of taunting everybody is so brilliant, and it's really amazing listening to the book. I'm just going to say reading the book, it's just, you know, hearing kind of all these, really specific details about all these killings and everything is just unreal.
And what's that book called by Graysmith?
It's called Zodiac.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. That makes sense.
Yeah. So you can probably find it.
Okay. My number one is another movie I mentioned again, sorry, on this podcast, and it's 2001, A Space Odyssey. But I do have an interesting thing to say about, I think, I actually thought about another Kubrick movie, Eyes Wide Shut, and I was trying to think about, like, what is it about Kubrick? You know, he was on your list, Lee, as well. But like, I think what it might be, I mean, in this movie in 2001, like there's something so robotic about mankind in the movie, you know, like the characters are almost secondary to the sort of the scenery and the sort of technology and Hal, for example, they, you know, things kind of happen to people as opposed to, you know, them making things happen. And I don't know, that just has this sort of a scary feeling to it. It just feels like we're sort of not in control of ourselves, and you know, I don't know.
No, I mean Kubrick. I mean, The Shining obviously is another one. Yeah. I mean, Kubrick definitely.
Or Clockwork Orange. Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, he's.
There's something about the way his he directs actors or actors appear in his movies that gives you that sense.
It's everything so like methodical and like. Almost monotone in some cases, that where it's like it almost makes you question people's motives. Like, he does such a good job of like sort of putting this element of mystery behind every character's eyes that, you know, creates that sense of dread.
Yeah,
I feel like Kubrick's, almost any one of his movies could fit this list. All right, so my number one is a movie where one character in particular epitomizes dread and foreboding, and that is Anton Chigurh in No Country for Old Men.
That's a great pick.
Interesting. So I think it works in that one character, but I don't know if it works as much for the whole movie.
I think it works for the whole movie because he ultimately wins in the end. He survives. He's the one, that remains standing. And it's, and then he ends up going up against, I don't know what the actress's name is. He plays Josh Brolin.
Kelly MacDonald,
who sort of epitomizes this sort of
innocence and
innocence, this niceness, and you're not going to be able to, I don't know. I think that movie itself is about dread and fear and death, and I think it's a perfect number one.
All right, my number one is actually perfect. It's a movie I watched just the other day. Sent you guys a Snapchat of it. It's Camouflage.
Oh, wow.
No, I'm kidding. You can cut that out if you want, Chapin. Although that would fit this list.
It would. It's pretty dark.
It's pretty dark.
Actually, watching your featurette on that was made my month. Anyway, my number one, Jeremy, you mentioned Lars von Trier. I'm going with Melancholia. Yeah,
that's a really good pick.
That should be on all of
every element of that movie, and the mood of that movie is dreadful, and it's such a great movie. And I'm not the hugest Lars von Trier fan. I mean, I don't know how big of a fan you can be of Lars von Trier. We talked about it last week, but I do like a few of his movies. But Melancholia is the one of his that I absolutely loved, and I can't say enough good things about it from start to finish.
Yeah, I think it's a better pick than Dancer in the Dark. I'm going to say it right now. I think that is...
Dancer in the Dark is...
But I think you're... Like, Melancholia is literally... It epitomizes it.
Well, thank you for listening to the... I think this is the 94th Get Your Film Fix podcast. I've been Chapin Hemingway, joined by Lee Carlo and Jeremy Fisk. And please, as I mentioned at the beginning... Give us a rating on iTunes, download some past podcasts, subscribe if you haven't, I'm sure you have, and, write a review. That'd be cool. All right, take care.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.